You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? This week's guest is Andy Cunningham. Andy is the founder and president of Cunningham Creative, a marketing, brand, and communication strategy firm dedicated to bringing innovation to market. She is also the author of Get to Aha, Discover Your Positioning DNA and Dominate Your Competition, and the host of the popular podcast Marketing Over Ice, an entrepreneur at the forefront of marketing, branding, positioning, and communicating the next big thing. Andy has played a key role in the launch of a number of new technology categories and products, including the Apple Macintosh, over the past 35 years. Today, she advises startups, serves on several corporate boards, is a Henry Crown Fellow, and a trustee at the Aspen Institute. She is a graduate of Northwestern University and lives in Sausalito on an old wooden boat with her husband, Rand Siegfried. Andy, welcome to On Brand.
Thanks, Nick. It's great to be here.
That is great. It's good to have you. And I am so excited. You know, it's fun to read people's bios. And I like when someone adds a dash of curiosity at the end. I don't believe there are any other guests that live on an old wooden boat. Apologies to anyone else that's been on the show that has not told me about their old wooden boat. But that is an interesting place to call home.
It is. My husband and I became empty nesters last year, and we decided to do something a little bit crazy and join the tiny house movement. So we sold two houses that we had and got rid of a lot of stuff. And we moved on to this old 1932 wooden Stevens motor yacht. And it's just been a fantastic experience. It's been 1 year now, so we're really enjoying it.
That sounds wonderful. I have five kids, so I look at the tiny house movement with longing that I could ever have so few things. I feel like if we got one now, I have a friend that has one, and it's in her backyard, and she uses it as an office. And I feel like if I did that, then that would be where the kids would want to go and play. That would be the one interesting place. They would abandon the rest of the house for the tiny house.
Always. They always want to be where you are.
So, you paid me the very kind compliment of saying that I have a fascinating background, and I said that I have to say the same to you. And, you know, I think that when we talk about someone who's spent their life, spent their career working on the next big thing, and that one of those next big things includes the Apple Macintosh, that seems really as good as any place to start. What was that experience like when we talk about branding and brand development? I mean, that's really on the timeline, that's a great big blip in the history of branding.
Yes, and I was so fortunate to be there at the right time. I came to Silicon Valley in 1983, in early 1983, and Apple had just launched the Lisa computer, which was pretty much an abysmal failure. And I was working for an agency called Regis McKenna, who was the guy in Silicon Valley as it relates to communication and public relations and marketing strategy. And he invited me to be the person to help him launch the Macintosh. And there was only one other person still left on the team. Everyone else had quit. So it was me and this one woman, Jane Anderson, and the two of us put together the Macintosh launch plan. And it was, we knew it was the next big thing. I mean, that was pretty clear, and it was so exciting to be a part of that. We built this plan. We asked for $500,000 from Apple to execute it, and we were met with the response, "How much more do you need?"
That's a nice and somewhat rare response, I feel.
Yes, very rare. Yeah.
So, in, you know, as that's such a model that so many are looking at, what was the, in terms of, you know, especially as brands, especially next big thing brands, I'm not sure if that's a technical term, but next big thing brands are so hard to get your arms around what they are. And you knew it was the next big thing. How did the team work on distilling that into a brand that people could connect with?
Well, you know, that's actually a really interesting story, because it's an interesting story about a brand pivot, actually. And most people may not remember this from that era. But when we launched the Macintosh, Steve Jobs wanted this to be the IBM PC replacement. He wanted it to get into the businesses, get into the office environment, and push out the IBM PC as the business computer of choice. And you may remember that his tagline back then was the computer for the rest of us. What happened when we launched it is it was pretty clear businesses had no interest in buying it. So we actually positioned it incorrectly to start off with. But what happened was it caught the eye of the creative community. And we began to see that creative people really identified with the Macintosh and actually saw the personality in the Macintosh and began to bring it into their lives, even into their businesses, but through the back door, through the door of the creative department. So we began to see that we were building market share in little pods inside of the business community, but not where we thought it would be. It was much more in the creative departments and the marketing departments. So what we figured out over time is that the computer was not so much the computer for the rest of us, but what I like to say, the computer for the best of us, the people who were really focused on marketing and creative. And that's how the Mac got into offices. So we repositioned it about 6 months in, much more as the cult, if you will, that it became. We didn't know it was going to be a cult going into it. That's something that happened later. We observed what was going on in the market, and we made the appropriate changes. But it was we did it in the right time frame, and it made all the difference in marketing the Mac.
Well, and it's interesting because you talk about the cult of it, and I think that that's one of the things that so many want to tap into. And I think what is in your story is the key to developing a cult brand like that, which is knowing your people. So what did you, that is a pretty big pivot going from I love the idea of the rest of us to the best of us, but I would say that's also a different customer. So that's a big pivot.
It was a big pivot, and people don't remember that. But the first 6 months of the Mac were pretty much another dismal failure, and so we had to figure out what was going wrong. And the great thing was is we found that there was this amazing attraction for creative people to the Macintosh, and so we capitalized on that. And a lot of what happened after that came from that. And by the way, Steve was always a rebel. I mean, you remember the 1984 ad? You know, that was one of the most that's an iconic ad of all time, and that had that little rebelness going on it. So Steve always had that rebel concept, but what he didn't realize is that he thought that rebel concept was going to push all the IBM PCs aside and make room for Macintosh, when it did not do that at all. So what we did is we just sort of took that rebel attitude almost to the hilt, to the max, and instead of trying to push the Macintosh aside, we tried to find our tribe. The Macintosh tribe, and get into the companies that way. And that's really how it ended up being as successful as it was. It was snuck in through the back door.
Well, and that's, I mean, I'd say that's probably the idea that was maybe ahead of its time, or the first of its time, is the idea of finding your tribe too. I mean, because I think that that's, You know, that's what we all strive to do now. But I don't know if that was quite the model then.
Well, you're right. It really wasn't, and it kind of happened to us. We actually noticed that the Macintosh had a tribe. We didn't know that. See, Steve, because of Steve's personality and his rebellious change the world kind of point of view, he felt that everybody would want to do that. He felt everybody would want to push away their IBM PCs in favor of the Mac. What he didn't realize is that his unusual point of view was a rare thing, and it was only attractive to other people with a similar point of view. And that's when we realized, oh my gosh, we have a tribe. And so what we should do is leverage that tribe to see if we can, first of all, attract all members of that tribe to the Macintosh. And then if we can we grow the tribe from there? And that's really, really what we did. But yeah, finding your tribe is critical. You know, the biggest problem we marketers have with our companies and our clients is everybody wants to be all things to all people. And that's exactly the opposite of finding your tribe.
Well, I think it's funny. It's one of those things that there's like this disconnect, because I think you talk about we marketers. I feel like we'd all hear something like that, we'd all nod along. But then when we're back in the boardroom around the table with others, the other thing feels safer. The all things to everyone.
Yes, it's so funny because that's the one thing that no one or nothing can be. But that's the one thing everybody wants their personhood to be, and they want their product to be. And so what happens is marketing messaging gets convoluted with too much stuff, and then there's no target for it. There's no, you know, tribe for it. So that to me is probably the biggest issue that marketers face, is they need to find their entry point in the market with a new innovation or a new technology, and that's always going to happen through some form of a tribe. Or as Jeffrey Moore says in Crossing the Chasm, you know, it's the early innovators and the early adopters that are going to grab onto a new technology and make use of it. And those are the ones you have to target going into the marketing equation, not the, you know, the laggards. You got to get to the early adopters first. And this is especially true in technology.
Well, and I think it's also easy as history kind of rewrites itself, and there's, you know, really, as we talk about modern brands, nothing's been, I'd say, canonized more than Apple, more than the Mac, and that's what everybody wants. But I think you rewind to that story, and when you talked about the first 6 months being another dismal failure, I think we also, the way we remember that story and the way we put it to work is we've got to be this kind of perfect, fully formed brand coming out of the gate.
Right.
And I mean, that not only creates an enormous amount of stress, but it also could keep you from seeing a moment like you all saw there.
Yes. Yeah. It's quite illuminating once you put a product into the market and you see what actually happens to it. The best laid plans, you know, of mice and men don't necessarily come true in the harsh light of day with a real market. So it's really important for marketers to do the best they can to figure out what their brand is going to do and who it's going to be attractive to. But once it's out there and actually living in the real world, you have to pay very close attention to what's going on and take action quickly. Because I'll tell you this much, if we hadn't taken action at Apple, and of course Steve drove that, but if we hadn't taken action, we would have lost the opportunity to develop the Mac into what it became, because we were losing money. And over a period, if we continued on with that strategy of let's try to push IBM out of the way and become the business computer of the century, we would have lost that battle, and the Mac would have gone away, and none of this other stuff would have ever happened. So it was quick listening to what was going on in the market and quick changing and quick pivoting that enabled that product to do what it did today. And of course, now everyone, I'm looking at you at a Mac right now, through a Mac right now.
I know. It is, it's amazing, but also a very fragile moment that I think with a lot of important steps that might not be intuitive, that might scare people, just like we're comforted by, let's just be everything to everybody. I think a lot of these quick moves, these quick pivots, and listening to something that could potentially be new information about an audience that we hadn't thought about, that's scary.
It is. It is kind of scary. It does feel safer to say, well, my computer's for everybody. You know, I wrote this book, and you mentioned it in the introduction. It's called Get to Aha. And the most annoying question they kept asking me before I actually, finished writing it and when I was trying to get a publisher was, who's the audience for this book? And well, I'm like, well, anybody. Everybody's the audience for this book. And, the fact of the matter is that's really not the case. That's, of course, what I wanted. But the case is it's really people who are interested in marketing. It's communication people and marketing people who are interested in it. And until you go through the exercise of shaving that oh, my gosh, I'm not for everybody attitude off of your persona, the better you are going to be able to market what it is you have. And then if it grows from there, that's the next challenge, and that's what you should be doing. But you've got to start with your tribe.
So – You talked about the new book a bit, and obviously your career and all of the lessons learned and strategy going into that. What did you use? What framework led you to the book, or what was the story that you thought you could distill this into?
Sure. Well, I think some of your listeners who work in the agency world might appreciate this. So I had an opportunity to work with a client that was competing with Adobe. This was about 15 years ago. And this is a company that had just been acquired by a private equity firm. And they had put one of the private equity guys in the CEO spot. He didn't know anything about software. He didn't know anything about creativity. And he didn't know anything about technology, really. He was a finance guy. And the first thing he did when he came on board at the company was fire all the marketing people. So what was left was essentially him and a bunch of engineers. And somehow or other, he'd gotten my name, and he reached out to me and said, I understand that you can help us position ourselves against Adobe in the marketplace, and that's what I'm interested in doing. So tell me, how do you do that? Well, of course, I'm sort of dumbfounded because my answer is essentially what every marketer's answer is. Well, I'm good at marketing. I think about it. I interview you. I come back, and I go, ta-da, here's how you do it. and he's looking at me like, that's not how things work in the finance world. Can you tell me exactly how you are going to come up with that answer? And I realized I didn't know. This was something I was doing instinctively all of my life, like many people who are good at something do. And I realized if I was going to win this piece of business, I had to give him a framework, right? There had to be a process to this. So I went home that weekend. I locked myself into my Palo Alto office when it was a rainy, cold weekend. And I kind of reverse engineered the stuff I'd been doing for the past 10 years of my career. And I looked at all the companies I'd work with, and I figured out there really is a process to this. And there are six lenses through which you have to look before you can come up with the right positioning statement. And those six lenses start with, in my opinion, what the most important one is, which is, what is your DNA as a company? I've always treated companies like people because, they're made of people, they're founded by people, they serve people. So I figure they're very much like people. So I've always treated them that way. And I decided that I looked at all the companies I'd worked with over the past 10 years, and I saw that they actually fell into these three categories. They were either product-oriented companies, customer-oriented companies, or concept-oriented companies. And I noticed that they organized themselves differently. They measured success differently. They talked about different things in different meetings. They hired different kinds of people. And so I came up with this framework that the first of the six C's that you have to look at is really about your core and identifying a company's DNA and putting them in the right category so you can position the company from a place of authenticity is a much better way of doing the positioning. So core was the first C. Second C is category. What category are you in, or are you building a new one? The third C is community. Who are you serving, but who are the influencers to who you are serving, and how do you reach them, and what do they care about? The fourth C is all about competition. How's the competition positioning itself so that you can find the unique way of positioning yourself? The fifth C is all about context. What is the context into which you are launching this product or service so that you can be relevant with what's happening in the world today? And the sixth C is really a kind of a different one. It's all about the criteria that you have for the success of your positioning statement. So I make people write down the criteria they have for success of their positioning statement so that when we come up with it at the end, they actually know whether they've hit the nail on the head. And at the end of this process, what you get is the answer to, in my opinion, the two most important questions in business: who are you and why do you matter? Long answer, but that's the process.
Well, I love that backup, and I love the story too of one that's that I think many of the listeners can identify with. You know, we've done the well. That's what I do, and that's not always what people want to buy when they're talking about the process to work with a brand builder. They want that framework, and I love that. I write and speak about branding a lot, and I always like the idea of DNA as a metaphor, but I'm not smart enough at science to really deliver on it as effectively as I feel like I could. But
less complex than human DNA, that's for sure. But it helps you come from a place of authenticity, and that, you know, in today's digital world where everything is about dialogue with customers now, it's not so much about broadcasting what you want like it used to be in the 70s. It's important that authenticity is the place from which you start your branding. And by the way, Nick, I wanted to point out, especially to the readers, because I'm sure, or to the listeners, that this is the second book written on positioning. The first one was a really great book called Positioning by Jack Trout and Al Reese, which was written in the 70s. And they invented this concept. And the concept, as they describe it, is owning a piece of real estate in the mind of the customer or the prospect that differentiates you from all of the rest of the people who are fighting for that real estate. And that idea is still very powerful today. It's just that in today's world, you have to deal with the internet and the thousands of channels of communication you have with your customers, whereas back in the old day, you had advertising, which you had complete control over, and a few channels in the PR side to look at. Today, it's a very different world. So you've got to be much more rigorous about ensuring that the position matches the DNA and that it fits with those other five C's.
Boy, is that a great book. I am looking at it on my shelf right now. So that would be for listeners, in addition to buying Andy's book, if you've not read Positioning, you should. Jack Trout, I believe, just passed away this year.
You're absolutely right. He did just pass away. But Al Reese has been very kind to me with my book. He wrote one of the promotional blurbs. He's been great. We've been calling my book Positioning 2.0.
Well,
because that's what it is.
Yeah. And I guess it seems logical now that you mention it, and you note it in the preface as well. But it is very much, it feels very much a continuation of that work, too. And I think, especially as you mention how things are different today, we need to both build on that, but it is a continuing story with the conversation that we're having today.
Yes, definitely. So I recommend that book as well. It's seminal. I mean, it invented a concept that had never been invented before. It's just that today that concept requires a lot more rigor to get to where you want to go to, which I call getting to aha, as opposed to the getting to ta-da, here's the answer.
So with this foundation in place, I think another thing that marketers today struggle with is what happens to it. How can we make sure that these foundational pieces live on in all of the different places we have to be as marketers today?
And what do you mean specifically by foundational pieces?
I'm just talking about everything that goes into the positioning, the lenses, your six C's that define who we are, what we're about, what we stand for.
And why we matter. Right.
And how can we, because sometimes I feel like organizations go through that exercise and then go back to business as usual, and it seems like that's a key ingredient that we need to make sure is baked into everything.
That is such an important point, and that is really one of the most challenging things that I think marketers face today. Is once this exercise is done and you come to that aha positioning, then the real work begins, actually, because then you have to be relentless about making sure that all of your messaging and your narrative and all your owned, earned, and paid channels are mirrors of that narrative and of those key messages that you've developed with your positioning statement in them. And that's the hard part, because After somebody's done this for 3 months, they get bored with their own messages, but it hasn't even begun to resonate in the marketplace. And I like to say this is how we got Donald Trump. He was really great at this. He was really, really great. He is really great at this. He understands messaging. He understands his audience, and he understands the relentless repetition of that messaging. And you say what you will about him for other things, and I have plenty of things to say about that, but I will say that he is a master at positioning and messaging.
I always bristle at the Donald Trump and branding conversations because I take your point. It's tough medicine sometimes, but I feel like
it shows you that it really works, you know, and that's the point. And so all sides of any equation, whether it's political or whether it's business, can play this game and win. But you've got to know the game.
Yeah, that's so true. And I love talking about all channels mirroring that narrative as well, because I think that many even that have gone through this or exercises similar, that's a disconnect that's out there. And I think even, you know, in our little political jag that we just took, I think there's people that there's people doing good work that stand for things that are missing that last step because of that big challenge.
Exactly. And it's, you know, I've been in the job of having to police the positioning with companies, and it's a daily battle with numerous people. You have to get it in all of the recruiting materials, all of the internal training materials, all of the blogs, all of the websites, all of the social media, all of the sales training. I mean, it's just relentless. And people are fighting you at every juncture, not because they don't agree with the positioning you've come up with, but because they have a better way of saying it, or they're bored with it, or yesterday's customer didn't understand it, or whatever. So it's just a constant process of keeping those messages in the dialogue. And then if you've tried it for 3 months, like we did with the Macintosh, and realize, okay, something's broken here, then it's the job of that same policeman to go in and make the adjustments required to get the right stickiness on the messaging. So it's a huge job.
Yeah, well, I love policing the positioning. I sometimes think that people... That we end up in the role of being the brand police sometimes, but I think the positioning police have such great potential because, just like you said, of making sure that it's fighting through all of that and also the kind of current of the way we've always done things. Well, I didn't say that yesterday in the training materials, in the call center, somewhere there. And but I also think, kind of coming full circle, it leaves you open if there is a disconnect, that pivot isn't the end of the world either. It doesn't mean you've done it wrong.
Right. It just means you've paid attention to the market. I mean, in the end, we're always dealing with humans and human behavior and human emotion. And so you can never be 100% sure that all of the analytics that you've done and all the market research that you've done is going to do what you think it's going to do once it's in the market. The real test of all of this is what happens when it actually hits the market. And if it doesn't resonate, then you have to go back and fix it. But you do have to give it enough time to resonate, which I think is about 3 months. And if it doesn't resonate, then you've got to make the appropriate tweaks. If it does resonate, then you've got to double down and police it.
That is great advice. And also, I think, you know, when you talk about whether it's the financial services sector or someone coming from another frame of mind that's looking for that perfect formula, I think you can put it together into a framework like this, but also leaving it open to, but we won't know till it hits. I mean, it's not anything that you can, it's not like a product that you manufacture and, oh, I know it works on day one, right, and then we built several of them. It is missing the key ingredient of the market, which, as you note, is an even bigger ingredient today because of the conversation, the dialogue that we're having beyond the broadcast.
It's human nature, and that's one thing you can never predict.
Well, I could continue talking for a long time. This is fascinating. But it has come the time when I have to ask you, Andy, for a brand that has made you smile recently.
Wow. Well, recently, okay, that's a great. I have several brands that do make me smile, but I'll tell you one that has made me smile recently, and it's this brand called Cheddar. Cheddar is a new TV show. Actually, it's kind of dubbed itself as CNBC for the millennial generation, but I love the name Cheddar. I think that's great, like cheddar cheese. The hosts on this show are really engaging millennials. They do their homework. They ask great questions. They're not just pacing themselves through a day of TV. They really take an interest in what they're doing. And I love the brand. It's just great. They're on the New York Stock Exchange floor. That's where they broadcast from. And they're good at what they do, and they don't take themselves too seriously, and they have a great name.
Yeah, well, and it sounds like they know their people. And I am sitting here having that moment where I realize I have not heard of them, but then I realized I'm not their market. So I will go.
You're not millennial. Neither am I. But that's when I discovered them. I thought I did. I actually smiled. I thought that is very clever.
Well, that's cool. Well, I will have to go check them out and smile on my own. Andy, where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
Well, thank you. So first of all, I'd love to encourage people to buy the book. It's called Get to Aha. It's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And there's also an ebook version available. So that's one place. My website is, I have two of them. I have one for the company, which is Get to Aha. That's GET2AHA.com. Or CunninghamCollective.com is the name of my company. And then I'm available on Twitter at AndyCunningham4.
This is great. Well, we will link up to all of that in our show notes, and I second everything. And because we're talking about brands that made us smile and just marketing that makes us smile, I have to go with our closing here, the copy on the back of the promotional copy of the book, Get to Aha, that I'm holding in front of me, that says, "Trust Andy, Steve Jobs did." That is as good a closing line as I can think of. Andy, thank you for joining us on Brand.
Thank you, Nick. This was really great. Thank you.
And before we go, speaking of that dialogue that we have, I always like to flip the microphone around to our community. Recently, Steve Hutt gave us a holler on Twitter for our episode featuring IBM Watson's Amber Armstrong. Steve, thanks for listening. And a reminder that you can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, head over there, give us a quick rating and review, help others find the show. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.